I'm looking at Buddhism and government. I'm not going to go into very great sophistication because, of course, the question of government is now extremely complex because of the international character of political relations, economic tie-ups, and so forth. I'm trying to explore some of the principles that are to be found in Buddhist tradition and which do need a re-exploration in the current circumstances. I'm not going to be taking that very far because there isn't time and maybe I'm not really qualified to do so. Yesterday I was looking particularly at the notion of the Chakravartin Raja, the wheel-turning king. And for king, you can really read government of any kind, whatever kind. Early Buddhism is not particularly concerned with the type of government. It's not concerned with how government comes about. It's concerned with the moral quality of rulers or rulership. It's intensely idealistic, and that ideal of the Chakravartin Raja, the wheel-turning monarch, the wheel being the wheel of the Dhamma, has had a huge influence on Eastern notions of government. Had a huge influence in ancient India, especially in the form of the Emperor Ashoka, who is one of the greatest figures in world history, really. A ruler who very much tried to rule in accordance with these ideal principles that he discovered in Buddhism. And he left a record of his principles in some 40 or 50 rock-cut edicts, which are found all over India. I've seen some of them with my own eyes. They were carved in local languages. There are even some in the northwest, in Afghanistan, what is now Afghanistan, which were carved in Greek. And they're in many Indian languages, early Indian languages, in Sanskrit, in Prakrits, in languages very like Pali, and so on. Even, I think, there are some in Persian. But they set out his idea of government according to the Dhamma, the principles of the Dhamma. And if they really were the way he governed, and there's no reason to think they were not, it was quite remarkable considering that he was these edicts were cut in about 300 BC. And they directly follow on from the principles set out by the Buddha. But that notion of kingship continued throughout South Asia, Southeast Asia, and even into China and Japan, and underlay notions of rulership all over the Buddhist world, even if they weren't always honoured very highly. They were at least paid lip service to. But certainly in the form of Ashoka, other great Indian kings like Kanishka, they seem to have really activated them. Xuanzang, the Chinese pilgrim who came to India in the 6th century, was witness to Kanishka's rule and praised it very highly indeed. So Buddhism is intensely idealistic for government, but it's also extremely realistic about human nature. Is probably the main characteristic of Buddhism, if you like. On the one hand, it has a very high, lofty ideal, a lofty goal, but at the same time, a very realistic look at what actually motivates us and what we're actually like. So the notion of kingship in the sort of mythic story about the formation of kingship is one of recognizing that human beings tend to be exploitative, appropriative, and to act harmfully to each other, and that therefore they hand over responsibility for keeping law and order to kings, or you could say governments. So it's a Hobbesian social contract notion that in Hobbes's notion of the state of nature, which of course was a common early Renaissance idea of early Enlightenment idea of what human beings come from, the state of nature in which everyone is pitted against everyone else, the government emerges as a way of regulating our appetites so that they can conform together and that all are able to live in harmony and peace. So Buddhism sees that as the basis for the formation of government, but then it puts upon that government a very high ideal and expects it to act act its responsibilities towards the general society on the basis of these ideals. I should say that in the Buddhist foundation myth, the myth of the formation of government, there's the notion of taxes. The people give the king the power of punishment and life and death in order to keep order, and they provide the king with goods with which the king can live and which he can use for the benefit of all. So we looked yesterday at some of the things the Buddha himself directly said about the Chakravartin Raja, the wheel-turning monarch. And we noticed especially, first of all, that the wheel-turning monarch has great reverence for the Dhamma representing high moral and spiritual and human principles that transcend personal interest. So the government, the governor, the minister, the prime minister, the president, whatever you like to call him or her, honours something beyond self-interest, even beyond national interest. I thought that was quite important to add that in, because we seem to be entering a period where national interest is being raised as supervenient over all else. Make America great again, and so on. And you see, hear the same sort of rhetoric in Britain and all over the world. Which is quite concerning, because we have been through a period where supranational institutions, which embodied high principles and ideals, like the United Nations, even like trade regulation, seem to be being questioned and undermined even. It's a larger discussion, but I just point to an issue. The Dhamma, Chakravartin Raja, acknowledges ideals that go beyond the personal and even the tribal or the national, and tries to govern in accordance with them. The Chakravartin Raja protects all, provides protection for all members of society, even, according to the Buddha, for animals and birds. And we see this played out in Ashoka's rock edicts, where he forbids animal sacrifice and establishes hospitals for animals, 3rd century BC. The Chakravartin Raja looks to the well-being of all and safeguards their property, gives to those who do not have property what they need, and so on. A lot is made, I mentioned yesterday, of the not too great inequality being permitted by the Raja. The government tries to make sure that all have what they basically need. And there's not too big a sort of disparity between the very wealthy and the poor, which is very interesting and topical. This is what Piketty argues in his book on capital, that it's inequality that breeds disharmony. And it's there explicitly in the text, in the Buddhist text, the way in which poverty breeds breaches social harmony and leads to disorder, social disorder. It argues that before the king should punish, the king should try to provide the circumstances where all have what they need, so that at least fewer people are likely to resort to criminal behaviour, you could say. And then finally, the Raja protects and fosters all religious devotees, all who devote themselves to a full-time, what we would call spiritual life, including Buddhist shramanas, but not exclusively Buddhist shramanas. The Raja supports all those who are renouncing the worldly life and trying to live for the sake of ideals, of high ideals. And I mentioned yesterday, I would add to the list artists, those who are trying to express high ideals through aesthetic means. So the Raja honours and supports all who lead such a life and resorts to them in order to gain from them a clear idea of the ideals and principles which the government can then apply within society. So it's very interesting and almost complete picture. But that the ideal of the Chakravartin Raja is worked out in greater detail as Buddhist history goes on. That the source, the main source for what a Chakravartin Raja, the ideals that a Chakravartin Raja should live up to, is to be found in the Jataka stories. The Jataka stories are non-canonical. They're a hodgepodge. Is that a right word? Is that a word we use? Or have I just made it up? Okay, a hodgepodge. It sounds like I've just made it up. It's a real word. Okay, thank you. Sometimes you're not quite sure what's coming out of your mouth, but, well, I'm not. It's a hodgepodge of material from all sorts of different sources. Some of it is just old Indian myths, sort of, like Aesop's fables, which are then sort of the Buddha is interpolated into them. So there's a story about, there's a wonderful one about Cemetery Dog. He really does sound like a New York hip-hop artist, doesn't he? Cemetery Dog. Anyway, I'm not going to tell you the story, but Cemetery Dog is a really good dog, much better than the Palace Poodles, but that's another story. Seriously, this is what the story is, Cemetery Dog and the Palace Poodles. Because Cemetery Dog, I'm going to tell you now, Cemetery Dog gets accused of stealing from the palace kitchen, but Cemetery Dog knows it's actually the Palace Poodles. And anyway, the Buddha was Cemetery Dog in a previous life. So this is the way. This is one strand in the Jatakas. Just so fables, Aesop's fables, but sort of Buddhified. I did make that up word up, didn't I? But some of them purport to be the Buddha's own memory of past lives. Whether that's so or not, whether you can take that literally or not, he's presented as himself having been a Chakravartin Raja a number of times in the past. And as a Chakravartin Raja, he follows the Dasa Raja Dhamma, the 10 ideals or virtues of a Raja. So I'm briefly going to run through these because they are an extremely interesting and very important list, which for some reason we don't hear much of, because I think our account of the Dhamma tends to focus on the more psychological and personal transformative side rather than on the side of social transformation. I think we need to focus on that much more given the state of the world and the state of politics, if you like. I think we need to have standards to which we hold our politicians. It's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, like in Italy, just recently the Five-Star Movement has come out ahead in the polls, and it's basically an anti-establishment movement, which is highly critical of the old political establishment. What will come of it, we'll see. We had the same sort of thing in India with the Aam Aadmi, which means the common man movement. And of course, when they actually did get into power, they were just as corrupt as everybody else. But there is a general sort of suspicion and debunking of our politicians, which I think is quite a serious problem. Not just that they are to be are debunkable, but that we debunk them, because it really devalues the relationship between the citizen and the government. And so I think we need to have a clearer idea of what standards politicians should be held to. And we get in this list a very clear set of standards. Of course, it doesn't just apply to government in the national sense. It applies also to those who lead any institutions, which is one of the reasons why I've chosen this, to make poor Surya Gupta, who's just completed 2 days as the new chair of the centre, shake in her shoes. Anybody who takes responsibility needs to take that responsibility in accordance with the Dhamma, and these principles will, to a greater or lesser extent, apply. Because if you have responsibility within an institution, you affect people. So if you are the chair of a centre, I know this myself, if you are a chair of a centre, your own conduct and the moral quality of that conduct has a big effect on other people. You know, I have been known occasionally to lose my temper. Some of my old friends will know very well. And if you are in a responsible position and you lose your temper, it has a disproportionate effect, because people are relying on you, they're respecting you. And so your moral failings have a big effect on the whole institution. So when you take responsibility, a new standard of morality comes into play. I think that when you take responsibility, you have to accept that your moral reach is far greater, and so your standards have to be higher. And it's hard to face that, but it's obviously true. This is coming under scrutiny, isn't it, at the moment, of, you know, sexual morality in amongst those with powerful positions is being under scrutiny, quite rightly. So 10 Raja Dhamma, the 10 virtues or ideals of a Raja, just very briefly, they're quite known to us mostly. Dana, generosity. Of course, here the emphasis on the government receiving from the wider populace, we would call them taxes, but the responsibility of government is to use those taxes for the benefit of people, to use them generously. I work in India, and what one sees there is that often political position is taken up for the ability to appropriate personally, so that the emphasis is on coming into government for what you can get and for what you can give to your supporters. We'll come on to that in a minute, and it's a bit noticeable, some of the rhetoric that's coming out of some of the populist leaders in Europe and America at the moment is not generous. So yes, the government, those who govern, should be generous. Their attitude should be one of distributing, giving away, especially giving people what they need for them to be prosperous. So that, as I mentioned yesterday, the the Chakravartin Raja is supposed to provide land for the cultivators, for the farmers, to provide capital for the merchants, and so on. So the function of government is to provide the means of prosperity and to guarantee the means of prosperity to all, and to provide fair circumstances for all. You know, they often say, you know, the market knows best, but a good market has a good market inspector who looks at the weights and measures and ensures that the market operates fairly. So then, Sheila, morality, ethics, very obvious, perhaps not so much to say about that, but because the ruler has such a huge impact on the ruled, their morality needs to be higher than it would do for a private citizen, because their immorality plays out within their government, if you see what I mean. The most obvious one is that any selfish interest then gets played out in the acts of the government, and you know, the government rules then in the interests of itself and its own class, which is what you see in a class-based society, as Britain has been. That the government has been in the interests of the those with land, the landed gentry and magnates and so on, and one is concerned that government isn't carried out in the interests of capital, if you see what I mean. That the interests of the governors identify with the class of the capitalists. I have no objection to capital as such, but when the government becomes dominated by the interests of capital, then it becomes one-sided, manipulative, and problematic. So Sheila is the ability to rise above personal interest and to not allow your own self-interest to get in the way. This comes out again in the next, which is parikaga, which means self-sacrifice, putting your own interests back and putting the interests of all forward. One of the problems with modern democratic politics is that your interest becomes getting elected again. And so you sometimes sacrifice the interests of all to getting elected. It's a trade-off that any politician is going to have to make, and I can understand that it has to be made to some extent. But it can become too much. There's another thing here. It's also parikaga is defined in terms of renunciation, that the ruler renounces personal interest. The ruler should even live very simply. Again, something you really notice in India, that as soon as somebody gets power, all the gold comes out and the house gets bigger, the cars get bigger, and so on. So rulership is identified with wealth. But according to the notion of the Chakravartin Raja, the Chakravartin Raja should live a simple life, a renunciant life. Not exactly a monastic life, because the Chakravartin Raja is traditionally a householder, has a family, but should not amass wealth for self. Madhava is a very beautiful word. It's connected with the word for honey, and it means gentle, having a gentle nature, not sort of pushing self forward, not combative, oppositional, but mild, gentle in manner. Tapa means, it's connected with the word tapas, which means austerity. But here it means self-restraint, holding yourself back, holding your own interest back. And living again a bit like, I missed out Arjava, come back to that, Parikaga, living a life of simplicity, renunciation. Arjava simply means integrity, honesty, sincerity. What you say is what you mean, which is very difficult in modern political circumstances. And political rhetoric can mean that you, in effect, lose your own integrity. And it's noticeable that even politicians whose policies I don't agree with, if they're patently sincere, I respond to them, if you see what I mean. Because sincerity is a rare commodity in democratic politics often, unfortunately. Akrodha, or akrodha in Sanskrit, krodha literally means hatred or even cruelty. Even modern Indian languages, krodha means cruelty. But akrodha, or akrodha, means not cruel, but it means particularly having a sort of conciliatory manner, trying to resolve things, trying to get beyond opposition, trying to reach out even to critics and so forth. Not, you know, doing what happens as soon as people get serious power is dispensing with the opposition. Punishing people for criticizing. You know, for instance, this is something that's been happening in India. Cartoonists lampooning the government, which is the job of cartoonists, and a very important one, are being locked up. And so you have a creeping sort of suppression of opposition. Akrodha means you can take the knocks, and you actually reach out to those who are opposed to you or critical of you. Perhaps it's not actually said, but perhaps you also listen to them and try to see what they have to say. Avihimsa, ahimsa means harm. Ahimsa is very familiar from Gandhian politics, but avihimsa is a more Buddhist term. It means non-harmfulness, non-cruelty, non-hatred. It really means humanity, having an attitude of appreciation of the humanity of others, and therefore not retaliating against them, not trying to harm them in any way. Kanti or kshanti means forbearance or patience. Quite a lot of these are very similar, but they've got slightly different flavours. But they indicate this mild-mannered, non-retaliatory forbearance with what people, do, what they throw up at you. A recognition that human beings will be human beings, and an ability to tolerate. A tolerance is another way in which kshanti is translated. So it's again what the Ashoka demonstrates, tolerance of people who have different religious viewpoints, even supporting them, giving them money, protecting them, so that there's no sense that I will only protect my own. There's a protection for all. Avirodhana is a non-confrontational approach, a concern for all, even for those who are in opposition. So there's so much more that can be said, but and I've not really differentiated sufficiently between all these different qualities, but these are well known in the Buddhist East as the qualities that a government should have. And they have been in the minds of various Buddhist monarchs down the ages who've honoured these principles as best they can. Often, of course, they've honoured them in the breach, but they will all pay lip service to them. And until relatively recently, and even still in Thailand, the monarch is considered to be a Chakravartin Raja. Whether he is or not is another question. But that the monarch will adhere to these, or rather pay lip service at least, and perhaps more than lip service, to these principles. So they do give us a pretty good idea of what those who govern should be like. Whether that can be achieved in our own times is more difficult to say, but they give us an idea of what standards we as Buddhists should be looking for in those who we choose as our governors, as our Chakravartin Rajas, as our Rajas, hoping that they will be Chakravartin Rajas. The very least, we should expect them to hold some ideals and to be looking for something that's beyond mere sectional interest. I think this is a great challenge for democracy, because democracy is a way in which the competing interests of society can all be engaged in choosing government. But it then means that the majority tend to dominate. So a politician recently said to me, you know, I'm carrying out Brexit, fulfilling the wishes of the British people. I did say, I got a chance to say, well, of the small majority of those who actually voted for it, but it's that it's fair enough that referendum was carried out. It came to a certain result. Whether it was sensible to hold a referendum is another matter. But that the idea of government that's upheld here is not that you rule on behalf of a particular section of society, but of the whole of society, and that you take into account the wishes of all. It's very strongly emphasized that the Chakravartin Raja is non-confrontational, but another meaning of Avirodhana is that the Chakravartin Raja tries to meet the wishes of all, which of course is ultimately impossible, but there should at least be that sort of effort. A couple more things that are said, which I'll just mention before moving on. Oh yes, in the cemetery dog Jataka, there's mention of the four roads not to be taken by the Chakravartin Raja, which are very similar. Partiality, shouldn't take the road of partiality, just ruling in terms of one particular section. Dislike, shouldn't. Personal likes and dislikes should not enter into government. Ignorance, in other words, not really knowing the true nature of things, not really knowing what's what people want, what's going on. Fear, anxiety is a very bad maker of decisions, and fear should not be in the minds of the ruler. So I want to move on to try to begin to look at how this all begins to play out in a democratic context. Most of us here come from countries which have a political democracy. I think maybe everybody, I don't know. That's not the only form of government in the world. And famously, Winston Churchill said that it's the worst form of government ever invented by human beings, apart from all the others that have been tried from time to time. It's a flawed system, but it's the best we've got because it provides for the orderly transfer of power, and it does provide opportunities for the expression of a wide range of different views. The problem with democracy is where there are significant minorities, which then can be easily dominated by the majority through democracy. It's one of the problems in India and in Hungary, as I was saying, that there's not a single gypsy in parliament. So it's very easy for democratic systems to dominate minorities, countries where there's a dominant religious system. That very easily means a suppression of minority religious systems. So, for instance, India is a large Hindu majority and a small, but we were quite large, small Muslim minority. The government increasingly is run in favour of the Hindu majority. You can see many examples of this worldwide. And one of the things that a democratic government needs to, democratic constitution needs to take into account is pluralism. It needs to be possible for there to be many different interests reconciled through the democratic process. It's one of the fights that Dr. Ambedkar had with Mr. Gandhi, who there was an attempt to put reserved seats in Parliament for what we now call Dalits, scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. But Gandhi opposed this, and it went on hunger strike. Dr. Ambedkar had to give in because it would have led to the death of Gandhi, which would have led to a huge bloodbath. But he was trying to build into the Indian political system, achieved it to some extent, a guarantee for minorities so that they have got a clear voice. Anyway, that's a side issue in a way, but it's an important one. It shows that democracy is not always a fair system. It doesn't always operate in the interests of all. If only the principles that we've been talking about could be applied within democracy, it would then mean that whoever was elected operated on behalf of all. I won't go on about modern politics. But I want to look a little bit more at how we could think about seeing how the democratic situation could lead to the creation of a what is called a Dhammarajya, a government based on principles, a government based on moral principles. I'm going to rush through this. I'm going to go into it much more carefully tomorrow, but I want to introduce the topic. So first of all, I want to just draw attention to the way in which things work. Facts of life, I'm going to tell you. Our actions, skillful or unskillful, good or bad, emerge from our mental states. This is fundamental Buddhism, that what we do comes out of our minds. If our minds are full of hate, then we act hatefully, and so on. If our minds are full of maitri, then we act kindly, lovingly. But our mental states come out of our view, our fundamental attitude to life, our fundamental understanding of life. I'm presuming most of you, I think, are familiar with these Buddhist ideas, so I'm not going to go into them very fully now, but this is the idea of drishti, view, attitude. If you have a basic understanding of life, let's say, for instance, in terms of life being about obedience to a divine force of some sort, and you understand that divine force in certain ways, then you shape your mind on the basis of those attitudes and understandings, and then that forms your actions. Do you see what I mean? You have an interpretation of experience, and on the basis of that interpretation of experience, certain mental states arise. And then out of those mental states comes your activity. And you can see, of course, this is what Buddhism is trying to deal with. We deal with our actions through sila, we deal with our mental states through samadhi, and we deal with our view through prajna. For those of you who understand that, it doesn't matter if you don't. But it gives you an idea that there's a structure to our action which moves from the inside out. It starts, originates with our fundamental sort of foundation of mind, our way of understanding and looking at the world, which then shapes our emotional and mental responses, which then shapes our physical responses. And all of this, of course, plays out when we go to the ballot box. When we exercise that small modicum of power that we have every 5 years or so, or slightly more frequently at local levels and so forth, we've got various views, attitudes and ideas. We interpret life, we understand life in terms of certain views, attitudes and ideas. So, for instance, we may have a materialist outlook. We may believe that there is nothing but matter, and that therefore nothing matters, if you see what I mean. That there's values are relatively small, relatively marginal. So we believe then that our own immediate interest in this short interval between birth and death is what is significant. So that means we have mental states that are formed upon that, and that then lead us to have certain attitudes to certain political policies and certain politicians and so forth, and that then lead us to put our cross on the ballot in a certain place, which then leads to the formation of a government. For instance, to strip it down to something really rather graphic, I spend time in Hungary and mainly working with Roma gypsies. Oh, not working with them, I'm supporting those who are working with them. In Hungary, there's a very right-wing nationalist and fairly explicitly anti-Gypsy, even covertly anti-Jew, anti-Semitic government. Not so covertly in certain places, certain respects. The generality of voters have experienced since the collapse of the communist system, have experienced first of all, they thought they were going to suddenly be living in Germany and that it was going to be really wealthy and everything was going to be fine. And then they realized that actually their industry collapsed in the county that we work in northern Hungary, as something like 40% of people are unemployed. Of gypsies, 95% are unemployed. So they experienced a great sense of hope and release and relief, and then suddenly a collapse. So who to blame? You need to find somebody to blame. Of course, the European Union, poor old European Union, everybody's whipping boy. The politicians who lay behind the who were involved in the accession to the European Union and so on, and then gypsies and Jews, they're responsible for our problems. When I was in Hungary last, this is really, really disturbing, but I'm going to really, really disturb you. All over Hungary, there were placards up announcing from the government a national debate, and the national debate was about the role and significance of George Soros, who's a Hungarian-American multi-billionaire who made his money on chasing Britain out of the exchange rate mechanism, Black Friday, you remember, John Major's nemesis, anybody who's old enough to remember. If you're around then, you probably won't be able to remember it. But he's a major philanthropist. He's given our friends lots of money to set up their schools. And he's set up a big university in Budapest, Central European University, set up the Open Society, which is based on the principles of Karl Popper. Really wonderful philanthropist. But he's a Jew. So they've got his face up, and it's in the classic 1930s pose. You know, he's got that sort of slightly wolfish grin on his face, which, as we all know, is, you know, what is it? That's what they're out to do. They're out to subvert. So you've got the manipulation of people's views, attitudes, and ideas. They feel upset, worried, insecure, and they see they're disappointed, envy. They see the wealth of Austria, their neighbour, and Germany, just across the way, as it were, and they feel somebody's to blame, and they're given, and they easily fall into, because of pre-existing anti-Semitic and anti-Gypsy attitudes, they fall into these attitudes. So that's behind. They go to the vote with that in their minds, and that creates a government which then, of course, sedulously cultivates those attitudes in them. And underlying it all, there's sort of attitudes to the Hungarian nation, there's attitudes of the special racial significance of the Hungarians. It's the 1930s in Central Europe. It's concerning. Hopefully, the European Union will provide, as it has done, some counter to that. But it's these attitudes that play out in the ballot box that play out in the government. So you can see where I'm going. If we want to have an ideal government, we've got to work on attitudes, fundamental attitudes and views. This is a huge task, We're going to look at it much more thoroughly tomorrow, but unless these attitudes are changed, and unless the nationalistic, often racist, often highly partial and sectional views, these views that are to do with an understanding of what life is, for instance, either crude materialism or crude theism, theism sort of mixed up with nation. Unfortunately, Buddhism's not immune from forms of this. In everybody's very familiar with what's happening in Myanmar, and what Sangharakshita calls a religio-nationalism, where the nation is identified with a religion. So, and this began, Sangharakshita's criticism of this began with criticism of the rewriting of the Sri Lankan constitution, so that Sri Lanka was defined as a Buddhist nation, despite the fact that it's a very large Hindu minority and a smaller but significant Muslim minority. And, well, they didn't like it. And eventually they took to an insurgency. A very bloody war was fought to suppress them. It was a direct consequence of religio-nationalism. And you've got the same thing going on in Myanmar. These Rohingya who've been hit there for generations and never been accepted as Burmese, the members of the state, the nation, the Myanmarian nation, Burma. Burmese is a racial term, if you see, a tribal term. They've not been accepted, and the reaction is as it were led by Buddhist monks. I've seen pictures of Buddhist monks going on the rampage, and I've seen the same in Sri Lanka. So unfortunately, Buddhism is not immune from this. In a way, I suppose it just shows us that all religion has an ethnic and tribal or group dimension, and we're unfortunately at the stage where that's not possible yet. We're not big enough to have that, but it will come unless we do our job properly. So these attitudes then shape people's minds and their responses to circumstances around them. They're manipulated by those who control the media and so on. And they lead to the choices at the ballot box, which leads to the kind of government you get. There's a very famous incident where Dr. Ambedkar, who'd written the Constitution of the Republic of India, which is a very admirable liberal democratic constitution, and extraordinary, somebody who'd been born into a family that was untouchable, considered untouchable, had actually has written the constitution of the largest democracy in the world. But in the Constituent Assembly, after the constitution had been accepted, he tried to get through a bill that would change Hindu marriage laws, giving property rights to women, equal property rights to women. And it was rejected by the Assembly. And he was bitterly, bitterly disappointed. And he's famously said, I would be the first person to burn this constitution. I don't believe in it anymore. We built a wonderful temple, a beautiful temple for some god to live in, but look who is occupying it, devils. And in other words, he was saying that constitutions, political systems are not themselves enough. What's significant is the mood, the attitude, the underlying view of the populace, of the voters, and particularly of the majority of voters. And his own conversion to Buddhism was, as much as anything, fueled by a recognition that there had to be a new attitude, which he hoped would come for the whole of India. That hasn't been fulfilled yet. But if there's a moral revolution in the views and mental states of the majority of voters, based upon the true nature of reality, on the Dhamma, whether you call it Buddhism or not, then people's choices at the ballot box will be on the basis of their healthy, skillful mental states and their proper attitudes to life, their views about life. And then you will have Dhammarajya. Then you will have the kind of rulers who are something like the Chakravartin Raja. But the democratic system puts the onus on the voters, puts the onus on us. And the question is, how are these, is this moral revolution going to take place? That's the big question. How is the moral revolution to take place? And you can probably already guess that I think we have a big part to play in that. Not the only people. I hope if it all rests on us, the world is doomed, the state totters. But that it's those who are trying to achieve a moral revolution in themselves who have a part to play in that larger moral revolution. And how I understand, and I believe that our Sangha understands this, I'll explain tomorrow. But I hope what you've followed me so far, we've kind of got an ideal picture of what a ruler would be like, what a government would be like, which is put very high indeed, and focuses on the moral qualities of the individuals rather than on particular policies. Because if the moral qualities are correct and the rulers are intelligent, then the policies will be at least inspired for the benefit of all. Politics is now an increasingly complex business, so it's difficult to find the right policies that suit everybody in it all the time. But yes, it places the ideal very high. And then we've looked at the dynamics of electoral choices, if you see what I mean, how they rest upon the individuals and their minds, and rest upon their views and attitudes. And it's the change in the views and attitudes that in a democratic society can bring about a truly a just and fair government. But that has to be led. It has to be educated. It's not just going to come about. There has to be a conscious effort to bring about that moral revolution. And it's communities like ours, I believe, that have a large part to play in that. Of course, I think that government should increasingly be looking to moral welfare of the people, but that's dangerous, because if the government is not moral, then the morality that it's inculcating is an immorality. So you see in Hungary, the government is rewriting the textbooks. So they're rewriting, especially history, because history is not about the past, it's about the present. So rewriting history so that it's the history of the Magyars. And the Magyars is a racial term, which is the name for Hungary. So they're writing a history of Hungary, which puts their racial group at the centre and has no place for the Gypsies, for instance, who I'm more conscious of because they're my friends. And Jews are very worried too. Many have started leaving again. So the moral revolution needs to be led, and I think we have a part to play in that. Of that, more tomorrow. Thank you.